Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
A powerful ocean storm has killed at least 11 people and forced the closure of one of Japan's busiest airports. Typhoon Jebi struck Japan's western island of Shikoku on Tuesday. With continuous winds of 160 kilometers an hour, it was the strongest storm to hit Japan since 1993. Boats rescued about 3,000 people who could not leave Kansai International Airport. The airport is built on a man-made island in Osaka Bay. Passengers who were trapped in the airport overnight said there was no electricity, food, or wireless service. The island was cut off when a large ship crashed into and badly damaged a bridge between the airport and the mainland. Runways at the airport were largely underwater after the storm struck Tuesday. Officials say they do not know when the airport will reopen. Kansai is an important airport for visitors to Osaka, Kyoto, and Kobe. It also is a center for the transportation of computer chips, electronics, and other exports. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga said on Wednesday that about 470 people had been hurt in the storm. Kansai Electric Power Company said that more than 400,000 people were without electricity. Businesses with factories in the area include Daihatsu Motor Company, Panasonic, and drink maker Kirin. The factories closed because of the storm, but were expected to reopen on Wednesday. The powerful typhoon comes after heavy rains caused floods in central and western Japan in July. More than 200 people were killed. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was criticized for his government's reaction to the floods. The Japanese leader canceled a planned trip to Kyushu to deal with the typhoon. I'm Mario Ritter.
Pakistan's newly elected Prime Minister, Imran Khan, met with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in Islamabad Wednesday. Khan said he hoped he could reset relations with the United States. He spoke just a few days after the U.S. government suspended aid to Pakistan over its reported failure to fight militants. "You know I'm a born optimist," said Khan, a former cricket player who became prime minister last month. A sportsman always is an optimist, he added. He steps on the field and he thinks he's going to win. Pompeo was in Pakistan for only 4 hours on his first visit to the country. At the airport, before leaving for India, the U.S. official said he was hopeful that the two sides could move forward. "We've still got a long way to go, lots more discussion to be had," he said, adding it was time for the countries to carry out their joint agreements. Pompeo held meetings with Khan, Pakistan's foreign minister, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and the powerful army chief, General Qamar Javed Bajwa. The new government gives the two sides a chance to continue discussing economic, business, and other issues, Pompeo said. He said that they spoke about the need for a peaceful resolution in Afghanistan that is good for everyone, including the Pakistanis. "I'm hopeful that the foundation that we laid today will set the conditions for continued success as we start to move forward," he said before leaving for India. Last weekend, the United States canceled a $300 million coalition support fund payment to Pakistan. The U.S. government said Pakistan was not doing enough to defeat the Taliban and other militants who attack Afghan and U.S. forces across the border. Pakistan has rejected those claims. Pakistani officials say their country has been a major player in the U.S.-led campaign against militants. It was launched after al-Qaeda attacked U.S. targets on September 11, 2001. Flying to Pakistan, Pompeo announced his appointment of Zalmay Khalilzad as the new U.S. Special Advisor on Rebuilding Afghanistan. Khalilzad, a longtime diplomat, is not well-liked in Pakistan. He has been very critical of Pakistan in the past, and his appointment will not help move things forward, said Zahid Hussein, an expert on militancy in South Asia. Khalilzad was born in Afghanistan. From 2001 to 2003, he served as U.S. Special Envoy to the country following the collapse of the Taliban. In 2003 to 2005, he was the U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan. He often blames Afghanistan's lack of security and other problems on Pakistan's military and ISI intelligence agency. He has accused them of helping Taliban forces. Neither the United States nor Pakistan can afford a full break in relations, Hussein said. He added that Pakistan is angered that the relationship has been reduced to a single issue, Afghanistan. As an opposition leader, Khan often criticized Pakistan's use of U.S. financial assistance. He briefly stopped trucks supplying fuel and other goods to U.S. and NATO troops from crossing into Afghanistan. He did this to protest U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan's tribal areas along the border. In a speech following the July 25th elections, Khan said Pakistan would not take part in the U.S. war on terror. He has called for a peaceful end to the Afghan conflict. I'm Susan Shand.
A South Korean company is operating the country's largest indoor smart farm inside a former road tunnel. The farm produces fruits and vegetables hydroponically, which means the plants do not grow in the ground. Instead, they grow on vertical equipment that provides a continuous flow of water. Indoor farms use artificial light instead of sunlight. There are other vertical smart farms in South Korea, but this one, built by the company NextOn, about 200 kilometers south of Seoul, is the nation's biggest. It is also one of the largest indoor vertical farms in the world, with a total area of 2,300 square meters. But what makes the farm even more unusual is the fact that it sits inside a huge tunnel. The tunnel was built in 1970 for one of South Korea's first major highways, but it closed down in 2002. NextOn signed an agreement with the government last year to take over the tunnel and turn it into a high-tech farm. NextOn officials say the tunnel environment permits ideal conditions for an indoor farm. It keeps a steady temperature of between 10 and 22 degrees Celsius. The tunnel is also completely dark, making it easier to provide exactly the right amount of artificial light. The farming system can produce more than 60 different kinds of fruits and vegetables. The company said foods produced in the indoor farm are also healthier, since harmful chemicals are not necessary to prevent large insect invasions. In South Korea, indoor vertical farming is seen as a possible solution to crop damage related to extreme weather that could get worse due to climate change. The country's farming industry has also been hurt by shortages of land and workers. South Korea's agriculture ministry announced earlier this year it plans to invest in smart farm development nationwide. Those plans call for nearly doubling the current area for such farms. Farming experts say high-tech farms, also used in Dubai and Israel, could be a good way to deal with problems many countries are facing with weather, decreasing farmland, and fewer agricultural workers. It can be difficult, though, for smart farmers to make a profit because of the high cost of building and operating. But NextOn said it cut its building costs in half by using the former tunnel and developing its own lighting and water systems. These technologies reduced water and energy use and the need for workers. Sensors also measure things such as temperature, humidity, light, and air quality. NextOn says the crops will cost less than other organic vegetables grown today. Operators of the farm say they even provide music for the plants, since the tunnel blocks out any real sounds of nature. We are playing classical music because vegetables also love listening to music like we do, said the Nexton's chief, Che Jie Bin. The company says it plans to expand its farm inside the tunnel in the near future to begin growing even more kinds of fruits, as well as plants used for medicinal purposes. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. For most of the 1990s, the nation was at peace. The Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, bringing an end to years of costly military competition. During the 90s, the American economy recovered from a recession and grew strong. Inflation and unemployment were low. There were new developments in medicine and technology. The internet began to evolve from a defense project, mainly linking researchers, into a new way for the world to communicate. America grew by almost 33 million people during the 1990s, the largest increase of any decade in its history. By the end of the 90s, more than 280 million people were living in the United States. During the decade of the 90s, there was a large increase in immigration from Latin America, the Caribbean, and Asia. For the first time in 70 years, 1 in 10 Americans was born in another country. At the same time, the population was getting older. That added to the nation's health care costs. America's new president, Bill Clinton, promised to reform the health care system. But in the end, like other presidents before him, Clinton failed to win support for that idea in Congress. Divorce rates in the United States had begun to grow sharply in the 1970s. By the 90s, those rates were starting to drop. But there were millions of children living with only one parent or with their grandparents. Single-parent families are more likely to be poor. In 1980, single-parent households represented about 20% of all households in the United States with children. By 1990, that number had reached 24% and was continuing to rise. In 1991, a black man named Rodney King led police in Los Angeles on a high-speed chase. After the chase, officers tried to arrest him. A man living nearby videotaped police officers striking King repeatedly with their sticks and kicking him on the ground. The officers later said King had resisted even after they shocked him with an electric stun gun. The man took the 81-second video to a local television station. Soon, people all over the country were watching it. The beating led to criminal charges against 4 white police officers. The trial was moved out of Los Angeles. Their lawyers argued that the officers might not receive a fair trial there. On April 29, 1992, a mostly white jury in a community north of the city returned its findings. The jury found the officers not guilty of assaulting Rodney King. Anger at the jury's verdict soon led to rioting that began in the largely poor black neighborhoods of South Central Los Angeles.
Don't go near this area, South Central Los Angeles at Florence and Normandy, because there is still no police presence there, and a lot of people trying to get through that intersection have been assaulted with rocks and bottles and sticks.
More than 50 people died in days of violence before police and troops brought the unrest under control. Many more were injured, and hundreds of buildings were destroyed by fire. It was some of the worst rioting in American history and received worldwide attention. The following year, a federal jury found two of the officers who had beaten Rodney King guilty of violating his civil rights. They were sent to prison. Another case in Los Angeles that received international attention also involved a racial element. O.J. Simpson, a black former football star and motion picture actor, was charged with murdering his white former wife and a male friend of hers. They were stabbed to death in 1994. Many legal experts believed the case against Simpson was strong. So did many more whites than blacks in public opinion surveys. A mostly black jury found Simpson not guilty. But later, in a civil case brought by the victims' families, a mostly white jury found him responsible for the killings and ordered him to pay damages. In 1990, researchers launched the Human Genome Project. This was a government-supported effort to identify and map all of the genes in the body. The Human Genome Project raised hopes for new medical treatments and cures for diseases. The project lasted 13 years until 2003. In 2000, President Clinton announced the completion of a working draft of the genome.
It will revolutionize the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of most, if not all, human diseases.
During the 1990s, personal computers became more and more a part of everyday life. And more people were going online over a network linking computers around the world. The internet would grow into an easy way to send email, find information, and buy products over the World Wide Web. In music, many Americans in the early 90s were listening to a new sound from the Pacific Northwest. It became known as grunge rock. The capital for grunge bands was Seattle in Washington State. One of the best known bands was Nirvana. Their 1991 album, Nevermind, contained some of their most successful songs, including Smells Like Teen Spirit. Kurt Cobain helped define the grunge sound. He was Nirvana's lead singer, guitar player, and songwriter. But in April 1994, that voice was silenced. Officials said he killed himself with a shotgun. Kurt Cobain was 27 years old, the husband of singer Courtney Love, and one of the most influential musicians of his day. On television, millions of people watched shows like ER, a drama series about a busy hospital emergency room. Many fans tuned in to watch George Clooney play a young doctor on the show.
What's going on?
Mr. Abbott asked us to try to resuscitate his son.
Still flatline, atrophy, tube epi.
He shouldn't have made it through the night.
No,
the hell are you?
I'm Dr. Ross. Look, he was in my care.
ER first went on the air in 1994 and lasted 15 years. Law and Order was a crime drama, but it took a different path, involving the interactions of police, lawyers, and judges. The popularity of the series, set in New York, led to several related Law and Order spin-off series. For laughs, millions of people watched shows like Seinfeld and Friends. The Friends were Ross, Rachel, Monica, Phoebe, Joey, and Chandler, six young New Yorkers. Seinfeld was also set in, you guessed it, New York. It starred comedian Jerry Seinfeld playing himself. The series was hugely popular and won many awards. TV Guide magazine put it at the top of its 2002 list of the 50 greatest shows of all time.
I'm sorry, excuse me one second. Hello?
Hi, would you be interested in switching over to TMI Long Distance Service?
Oh, gee, I can't talk right now. Why don't you give me your home number and I'll call you later?
Well, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to do that.
Oh, I guess you don't want people calling you at home.
No.
Well, now you know how I feel.
Seinfeld was, in the words of its creator, a show about nothing. But Jerry and his friends, Elaine, George, and Kramer, managed to find plenty of humor in life's everyday problems and situations. Another popular show in the 90s was the animated series The Simpsons, which, like Seinfeld, premiered in 1989. New episodes of The Simpsons, Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie, continued into the 21st century.
Titanic was called the Ship of Dreams. And it was. It really was.
All right, open your eyes.
The 1997 film Titanic became the first movie to reach $1 billion in ticket sales at theaters worldwide.
You never know what hand you're gonna get dealt next. You learn to take life as it comes at you.
When the ship docks, I'm getting off with you.
Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet played young lovers on the famous ship that sank in April 1912 after hitting an iceberg in the North Atlantic.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Another popular film was Jurassic Park, released in 1993. In it, dinosaurs from prehistoric times are brought back to life with disastrous results.
We're gonna make a fortune with this place.
In sports, baseball players went on strike in 1994. The World Series championship was canceled that year. In basketball, millions of fans were watching Michael Jordan lead the Chicago Bulls to championships. As the 90s came to a close, people around the world were preparing to celebrate the arrival of the year 2000. It was a big event, but there were also concerns about the millennium bug, or Y2K issue. This was the worry that older computers might not be able to recognize the calendar change. Lots of activity went into making sure things would go smoothly after midnight on December 31st, 1999.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.